Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello and welcome to What I Wish I'd Known, in association with Speakers for Schools, the youth social mobility charity, which provides inspirational speakers and work experience opportunities. I'm Alice Thompson.
And I'm Rachel Sylvester.
And in this podcast, we talk to extraordinary people who've lived astonishing lives. Why is it that often the people with the hardest beginnings in life become the most successful adults? And is there something to learn from these people, who perhaps have the strongest sense of what matters most?
In this series, we'll be speaking to a collection of remarkable individuals about how they achieved success in the face of adversity.
Welcome to What I Wish I'd Known.
In this episode, we welcome master English saddlemaker and leather expert Susie Fletcher.
Susie is best known as the resident leather expert on the BBC's Repair Shop, which follows a workshop where broken or damaged family heirlooms are brought back to life by master craftsmen.
Her early life was idyllic, and her own love of animals was a constant force in her younger years, horses being especially important to Susie. But she struggled with dyslexia, which made school tough, even though she was bright.
Her focus instead turned to craft, following in her father's footsteps. He was a horologist, but Susie's craft wasn't watches, it was saddles for horses. She would go on to work on harnesses for many state events and built a strong reputation for saddle making and leatherwork. And her love of the craft continues from the joy she gets from restoring people's sentimental objects on the repair shop.
Every story brings something that I really feel within that story. It can be as simple as a lovely gentleman called Peter at the end of it. He just turned round to me and he said, "Thank you for letting me talk about my dad. We don't get the chance to do that often." And I just thought that was a really gentle sentiment to say, and it came from his heart.
What did you make of Susie's early life?
It was obviously a really idyllic, happy childhood, growing up in rural Oxfordshire with her horse. She was very close to her brother. There wasn't a lot of money. She talks about how there wasn't heating in their house and it would often be really cold when they woke up in the morning. But it was a really beautiful place and she seemed very happy.
But her luck changed, didn't it, when she went to America, which at first was a great opportunity for her. She was in Boulder in Colorado, but then she met this man and really he took over her life and her future.
The first time he was violent, boy, I was shocked, but I knew I was in trouble. I sensed it the instant the incident happened that triggered him. And I did run the wrong way through my house to where there was no escape. And I knew as I ran that way, what are you doing? You know, it's really weird when you look back and you think about all these things and you go, how could that have happened?
Susie talked a lot about the physical abuse, including she was once lifted off her feet by her neck, but it was a psychological torment that left her feeling so alone. I mean, he completely isolated her from her family and friends.
She's written a memoir now called The Sun Over the Mountains, and I think she's done it because she wants to explain to other people why women do get trapped in these relationships, and she wants other women who are trapped in them to understand that there is a way out, but also to understand that somebody else can see what they're going through and can feel the same and that they're not alone.
We know so much more about gaslighting and these terms of grooming and codependency and coercive behaviour. These are terms that I now know. I didn't know then. I couldn't rationalise this behaviour at all. This was a man who loved me. So I must have deserved that, was how I started to behave.
And she covered up for him so much, that sense that he obviously did feel inadequate, but he was trying to make her feel so small. And I think, you know, even when the family tried to get involved, she protected him from them. And he would lie about her family, and she didn't find out until a long time later. But even then, she kept she kept the faith in him. And when he was dying, she did too. She didn't want him to feel that the whole relationship had been a disaster. I don't think she wanted to feel that that relationship had been a disaster because she'd invested so much of her life in it.
I wouldn't have changed it for the world. I am so grateful for everything that's ever happened. And I'm really loving life. And I'm still very enthusiastic to what's coming around the corner. And I feel really energized every day. I still feel incredibly energized. I think having had all of these experiences have created the person that I feel I am today. Mm-hmm. And it is the moment that you're in today that really matters.
Susie started by telling us about the repair shop and her role on the programme.
Well, my role is I repair anything that is leather or leather related. And just through history, leather has been used in multiple applications. And even the producers of the repair shop in the early days, when they invited me to join the show, they thought, oh, you'll be on once or twice and, you know, we might be able to find you a few things. Then they realised how much leather has been used in all sorts of different applications. It's not just a leather saddle or a leather bag, or it's, you know, with washers, leather washers are used, or in instruments, there's little bits of leather used. So within this beautiful family of the repair shop, you've got all these different artisans that are able to repair items. But the crux of the repair shop is a member of the public coming in to share their story with us that revolves around the item that they brought in to repair. So on so many levels, it's a very lovely, generous, kind, listening to people and their stories and then being able to do something for them that continues the ability for that story to be told in this item. And who knew that that would take off like a rocket? Mm. But it really has, and it's resonated with so many people, not just in the UK, but throughout the entire world.
And you joined when you were 60, didn't you? Were you almost looking for a form of repair or a safe haven or new
Actually,
life?
I was 56 when okay. I joined, yes. Yeah, so I joined as I relocated back to the UK, intending to have a very quiet time, having had quite a lively time in the US. And 5 weeks after arriving in the UK, I was walking through those barn doors going, what am I doing here? How did they persuade me to do this? But hats off to them. I am really grateful for what they were able to do. And it's definitely been a huge part of me dealing with a lot of my own personal story.
Which heirloom is the one that you found most intriguing, or which story? Has there been one? Because there are some very complicated lives. Are those the ones that you're drawn to most?
It's interesting. It's very hard for me to say like that it's one category or one area. Every story brings something that I really feel within that story. It can be as simple as a lovely gentleman called Peter. At the end of it, he just turned round to me and he said, thank you for letting me talk about my dad. We don't get the chance to do that often. And I just thought that was a really gentle sentiment to say. And it came from his heart. And he was so proud to say that his item, which was a little leather elephant called Pookie, has stayed in my brain, which, you know, not everything stays there, you know. And these are the people that come to mind. It's the people and how brave they were in sharing some of their very difficult stories. Some of them are hugely difficult. Wendy is another one who came in when she was very, very ill. She's terminally ill, and she's just one of these people that had this aura around her. And boy, did we connect, and we went through the rest of her life in regular communication until her eventual passing. And I just felt really honoured to have got to meet such a beautiful person.
So, in a way, it sounds as if it's as much about the emotions as the objects. And you had yourself a 18-year abusive marriage, and you poignantly said it battered your self-confidence and your soul. Mm. Is that why you kind of like this idea of giving objects a second chance, if you like, or helping people to bring them back to life?
I think it's just inherently in my nature is to see value in everything. And I'm quite happy with the simple things in life. But I also look at things like if we look at objects, I look at them from the design point of view. It's like somebody actually sat down and designed that and sort of go down that rabbit hole. And I'm a designer. I like designing and creating because it's very healing and very enlightening. It gives you a lot of self-esteem when you produce something. And then with people, like with my husband, I mean, basically there was a person that had a lot of troubles in his younger years, and it had made him a person who was quite insecure and quite challenged in certain behavioural aspects. And I remained very loyal to him and very loving to him and always loved him and never changed my views of him. He was the way he was. And I am interested in people and why they are the way that they are, because we're all individuals and we all are the people that we are because of circumstances. Mm. So I'm going around this in a very roundabout way. A lot to answer there. And what was the original question?
Well, actually, we'd like to take you back to your childhood and talk about how your childhood sort of shaped you and made you the person that you are. And you're very tough and resilient, but also very empathetic. What were your early years like? Because they sounded pretty idyllic.
Yes, they were. Although we grew up with family challenges, as every family did, really, if you get to the nuts and bolts, it was idyllic. My parents remained married through all of their lives. I was the last of four, which came with its own challenges, because I wasn't supposed to be here, basically. But, you know, my parents showed the resilience of, you know, we've got four mouths to feed. My father was a very humble watchmaker. You know, they struggled to make ends meet. So as children, we grew up being, you know, very aware that in order to be able to function, you know, everybody has to realise that there are responsibilities as you grow up. But we also had lots of freedom. I mean, Steve, my brother, who's on the repair shop, he's the horologist. He and I often talk about the freedoms that we had as children. It literally was out the door, come back for meals. And that was how it worked. And so we spent a lot of time in the countryside and, you know, just doing whatever children do in the countryside. Mm. But we didn't have a lot of the material things.
Is it right there wasn't any heating in the house, for example?
No, there wasn't. No. I mean, and that wasn't unusual at all. Mm. At all. No, my first home, it was that typical thing of in the morning you'd scratch your name on the ice that formed on the inside, because that was what you did as children.
Right.
And then I do remember when my parents bought another home, they did put central heating in, and we were just like, whoa, this is amazing. But of course, you had to be able to afford the central heating. So only a certain room was kept warm again, and you still had very cold bedrooms, but that's fine. Mm. Yeah, that was just the way it was. You know.
And you were very much a tomboy, weren't you?
Huge.
Sort of happiest climbing trees.
Yeah.
Rather than being in school. Do you think you always knew you were unconventional? Were you always very creative?
It's interesting. I always felt different. I realised that I could sort of put a foot in any camp, that maybe I had a personality that was unthreatening or just curious and interested, but I'm more of a wallflower. You know, I tend to be a little bit more reserved than out there sort of character. So I was very comfortable on my own, but I also would be happy to join a gang, but I wouldn't be like a leader. And I was very much, you know, let's go with what you say. So I think I experimented a lot as a child and was happy to be out in the countryside. Many, many hours spent riding my poor pony, Jess. I mean, my goodness, that pony, what he went through. But it gave me that freedom and just learning to find your own path. So I was lucky.
And you were also very dyslexic, weren't you? Do you now think that's an advantage? Because it gives you this kind of different way of seeing the world and ability to think outside the box.
Yes. The more we're learning about all of these different brain functions, the more we're seeing that there are huge benefits to it. Whereas, you know, at school, I was just, my report would say, you know, friendly, sporty and arty, but not the brightest pencil in the box sort of thing, which in those days, again, it was a bit of a put down. You know, mum and dad were like, dear, what a shame. She's not bright. But in fact, I'm quite bright. And for some reason, I decided to go back to further education as an adult. And that's when this whole thing about being dyslexic came up.
So you had no idea when you were
a child? No, I had no idea. I just knew that I wasn't very good at this maths and English. And yet I'm phenomenally good at maths. I was doing it in my work and didn't realise that I see the patterns. The patterns, thank
Very
you.
Very dyslexic, isn't it?
Yes. So once you understand your brain works this way, then the confidence comes. But I was able to do the formal exams for maths, English literature and English language, and it was through Oxford Brookes, which is quite well known. And yeah, I got a gold star on all of them. So I'm not academic after all. My brain just works in another way.
And your first word was horse. Mm-hmm. I'm real horse obsessive. So yeah,
you get it.
Where did your love of horses come from? Do you know, or was it innate?
I believe it was from my grandmother. She's the lady that, although she never rode herself, I recently learned that she would bring the horses up from the stables to hitch up to the fire wagon for the fire brigade. You know, when they had the old hand pump that was horse-drawn, she used to bring the horses up. I never knew that. Her house was decorated with everything to do with horses. And so because of that love, it was my grandfather that helped facilitate me being able to go to riding school, which of course was an expense that my parents weren't able to facilitate themselves. And eventually he did buy me my pony. My riding instructor said to me, you're sort of getting to the point where you've got some really good skills, you know, in order for you to go further, it'd be really nice if you could have your own pony. And I knew that wouldn't happen. So I put an advert in the local paper saying, very experienced rider looking for a horse or pony to ride in a surrounding area, because I was willing to ride my bicycle wherever it was, and the telephone number. And so I got this call, and I remember the name of the person, and I remember everything about that day. And we went out to see this pony that was kept behind a pub in a village, and the actual owner was at university somewhere. And the pony needed somebody to look after it. And so that's how Jess came into my life. So I was there just to look after him. And then they sold him. And then my granddad was like, wow, I was so upset. I was heartbroken. And he made them an offer that they couldn't refuse. Oh. Basically, he gazumped. And good old granddad. And I mean, talk about what a lovely thing to do. I mean, it really was. But it came with provisos that I got a job. And I was about 13, 14 at the time. So I just talk about my dad giving me a filing job for his business. And of course, I'm dyslexic. So that didn't go down terribly well. Well, he couldn't find invoices, because I'm like, why doesn't W go in R? Of course it does. But yeah, I would do anything to earn some money. And it all went to keep Jess. Mm. So, I mean, that was a great lesson that my parents taught me, is the things you want in life, you need to work for. And that in turn brings such a lot of value and self-worth as well. I mean, you know, it's nice to have those dreams that perhaps one day I could possibly have a pony, but to learn that you can't have things given you, it's you have to work for it too. Great lesson in life.
And what was your relationship with Jester like? Was it different to, I mean, how does it compare to your friendships with humans?
Oh gosh, doesn't even compare. Anyone that has a relationship with an animal will have their own interpretation of that, and it's very special. But this relationship between man and horse, particularly women and horses, has been studied quite in depth, and it's a different relationship. There's an empathy and an understanding on both sides. And for me as a child, he gave me my wings. I mean, I had my transportation in Jess, as I say, I could pop on him. And at the weekends, we literally would ride all day long, or I'd ride to a ford and just take the saddle off and let him graze on the bank. And I'd be playing and just paddling. And maybe I'd go with a friend with their horse too. And you always expected the horse to be there. You never expected him to run away. He never did. I mean, that was the amazing thing. And when I look back at it now, it's like, gosh, I wouldn't do that now. One of the local pubs in one of the villages, they just put up a rail for us to tie the horses to, so we could have a fizzy pop and our packet of crisps and things like that. I mean, and it was rain or shine. We would go out. It didn't matter. Mm. That's all I ever wanted to do. I wasn't interested in anything else. And it did take all of my time. And even on those days where it was absolutely tipping down with rain and howling with wind.
And you made your first saddle for your doll's horse, didn't you? What was that like? Why did you do that?
Saddles have been something that have always interested me. I was instantly drawn to saddles, going in the tack shop or in the tack room of the riding school. It was really saddles that for some reason captivated my imagination, and more than happy to clean them, which meant I always had a job at the riding school. There is something about just leather, keeping it supple and fit for purpose. I just knew instinctively.
Was it the smell as well?
Smell, oh my gosh, yeah, the smell is gorgeous. Unfortunately, I'm quite nose blind to it now because I've been around it so much. Everybody's, they can smell leather on me because I'm surrounded by it. Yeah, it is. It's a lovely material. So the draw to saddles was something that came very early on, and to sort of figure out how to make one for, I think it was my Cindy doll, and I had a rocking horse and things like that. And I got more and more involved in it. And it's like, this is it. This is what I want to do. And it wasn't until...
It must have been tiny, though, for the
Yeah, dog. And I've still got it. I haven't got the first one, but I've got the, like, Mark III, where it actually has a tree in it.
Do you think part of it was because your dad made watches and that he was repairing them? And did you get a sense that that was quite normal to be making, creating and doing something, and that could be something you could do as a career or a job?
It was something that we grew up with. I mean, Mum, she was the fashion whore. She loved designing and making clothes, and she actually had won a scholarship to come to London to study at fashion school when she was 17, but her dad wouldn't let her come. She was his only child, and that's just the way it was in those days. So that was a bit disappointing for her because she had all of this artistic flair in herself, and I definitely inherited a lot of that. And then seeing Dad nuts and bolts, you know, with these tiny little bits that make up watches and all the little tools, and he would have all these glasses on, and you know, just see him day after day working solitary in the workshop. And my granddad, he worked on clocks, and also when he was retired, he never retired, who'd work on gramophones and radios and things like that. So I grew up surrounded by people that made and repaired. So it was quite normal for me to be also trying to fix things. It felt very natural.
And you then trained as a master saddler. Did that also feel like the obvious thing to do? It's quite a niche choice.
Yes, it was. And in the 70s, where women weren't necessarily going to become masters.
Were you the only woman there?
No, I wasn't. It was at the era where things were changing. And Ken Langford, who was my local saddle maker, who really introduced me into it, I had my place at Cordwainers College in Hackney before I left school, which was a plus. For me, it was very comfortable. It seemed the right place to be. I didn't have to question it for one moment. And I look back at it now and I think, how fortunate was I to have found my niche at that early stage of life? Because I think when you have sort of dyslexic issues and people don't understand you, it's quite easy to sort of get lost in not feeling good enough and not making the grade. You know, we all need our own self-esteem, not in an egotistical way, but we need self-esteem to function and feel capable to take the next step forward. So I am hugely grateful for all that happened and how it sort of developed.
And you were soon so good at what you did that you were working as the harness maker, well, with the harness maker to the late Queen. How did that come about?
Happy accidents. My life is full of happy accidents. If it wasn't for people and the stars aligning, I mean, none of this would have happened. And that came about through, again, my brother Steve. He happened to know some people who were getting together this harness making company, and they were going to have it in Witney, Oxfordshire. And they knew that I was a saddle maker and I'd done a bit of harness. And they asked Steve to ask me if I would like to join this team. And I thought, I really need to learn more about harness. So I'd pretty much got as far as I could get working with Ken. And he was all for it. I mean, he's, yeah, go forward, because the more you can experience, the better you're going to be. So I ended up working with Bill Turner, William Turner, who was then the Royal Warrant to the Mews. Fabulous opportunity. I mean, we had to re-leather several of the sets of harness that are hanging up in the Royal Mews now. And I think it was last year I popped in there And I said to Francis, who I'd worked with, I said, so which is the harness that I've worked on? She went over there and I had a look and I went, oh, I could see my work. And I was just like so thrilled. The only person on the planet was thrilled was me, but it didn't matter. It's that there was my work there in that showcase. And I actually felt, that's so cool.
You're listening to What I Wish I'd Known in association with Speakers for Schools with Rachel Sylvester
and me, Alice Thompson. There'll be more from us just after this.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome back to What I Wish I'd Known, in association with Speakers for Schools, with Rachel Sylvester.
And me, Alice Thompson. And our guest on this episode, Susie Fletcher.
So what drove you to Boulder, Colorado? Was it about the horses and the ranches and the cowboys?
Again, that was just a happy accident. I had previous year been in Illinois there, just looking at potentially staying there to work on an invitation through someone that I'd done work for. And I met Linda at a trade show. And Linda had heard that I'd sort of gone back to the UK while things were being sorted out. And she said, any chance you'd want to come to Boulder, Colorado? And I went, yeah, why not? So she did the paperwork and I ended up going there. And it was crazy.
What were your first impressions?
Oh, gosh. Well, I arrived in May. And it's beautiful. A springtime in Boulder, Colorado. Everything, spring comes quite late in Colorado opposed to here. Beautiful mountain ranges, just flying into Denver International. And you can see the Rockies that go north and south through the whole state. Mind-blowing. And the vastness of it, it's just beautiful.
And can you remember the first time you met Rob, your future husband?
Yes.
Okay, it's what funny. Happened?
Well, what happened was the night before it all started with Linda introducing me to margaritas.
And you've never had one before.
At high altitude. And I'm such a lightweight when it comes to alcohol. Yes, I was walking off a hangover the following day, walking up Pearl Street, which is a pedestrian walkway in Boulder, Colorado. It was just one of those idyllic spring days where the sun was shining, it was the right temperature, and everybody was out having a good time and lots of street entertainers. So I was just entertained while I was walking off this hangover. I was walking along. I think it's Stephen Wolf, Bad to the Bone is the track that always comes to mind. And there was this guy walking towards me with this swagger, and it was he had presence. I mean, he was tall and blonde, and he had these wonderful shades on, blonde moustache with the stubble. I mean, we're talking the 90s. He was wearing shorts and a cut-off t-shirt and high-top white boots, and he had this incredible tan and these muscles. I mean, it was just like, you couldn't help. I mean, I'm sorry, just couldn't help but notice him. I thought, oh, he's nice. We walked past each other, and then I turned to look, and he had turned to look too, and eventually we got to meet and chat, and that's how I met Rob.
So where was your first date?
It was that night. Mm. He came and picked me up and drove me into Denver, and we went dancing because he liked to dance. I loved to dance. It was incredible. It wasn't very often that I got to meet men who liked to dance. Mm. You know, they'd have to have several drinks in them before they'd get up and dance, but no, he likes music too, so... Yeah, we definitely hit it off on many levels. So, yeah, it was nice.
But he was also tricky on that first date. Did any alarm bells ring then that he might be complicated?
It was the second date that I realised that there was two sides to this person. And he came picked me up on the following Tuesday, straight from work. So he was quite grubby, tired. Yeah, very tired and not in the best of moods and quite snippy with me. And he had been drinking while he'd driven over. And I was just thinking, yeah, it's probably not a good idea. So maybe I'll just get out at this, you know, when he gets to the bottom of the road, I'm going to hop out and say, adios, amigo. But he didn't stop at the stop sign, so I couldn't get out. And then I really, the alarm bells were ringing and I thought, oh, goodness me, now what? So we had a little bit of a drive coming down the canyon. And it was then that he went, look, I'm really sorry, and made all the appropriate noises to say, you know, I've had a hot, tiring day. And, you know, so I gave him a second chance.
And why did you not sort of get out at that stage? Did you just, was he so charming that overcame it?
Hugely charming. Okay. Yeah, he was. He was, and I was in a, this is all very new and it was all very different. And that whole thing of, while I had traveled a lot, you know, when you meet people in their environment, you kind of have to learn how it works in their environment, because it is their environment. And he was somebody that I'd never met somebody like that before. You know, his character was quite different and he had this huge charisma and charm, but I also saw a vulnerability in him. And he was somewhat careful how he introduced the fact that he was Hispanic and American Indian, and his father was German American. So he was a real blend. But the whole Hispanic thing, particularly Mexican, people could be quite negative towards it. That this is sort of an introduction to the racism that you see in America, which I found really, really surprising, having thought that America was this very liberal and open-minded melting pot of all different nationalities. So he was careful how he introduced his nationality to me. And I thought, well, who cares? And he was like, oh. And he asked me things like, do you do drugs? And I went, no. And he went, good. And I went, okay. And then he went on to explain how commonplace cocaine was in Colorado. And I was like, never seen cocaine, you know. I was like, duh.
You know, he must have found it really refreshing, didn't he?
He did. He did. And the fact that, I mean, I suppose I was very, very different. And they say it's the differences that attract these people, and then they want to change you or harness you.
Because he was very controlling right from the beginning, wasn't
yes,
he?
Yes, he was. He was. And I was complicit in just going, oh, okay, you know, if this is what he needs, if this is what he, you know, is this what's going to make him happy? And maybe naively I should have challenged it more, but I do like to keep the peace. I'm very much a pacifist. I really don't like aggression or arguments. And that's not realistic at the end of the day. You can have differences. But I wasn't brought up in a volatile family. So to have that sort of anger shown to me just shuts me up immediately. Or it used to. Mm. It doesn't anymore. If somebody gets very angry with me, I'm just very calm about the whole thing. It's just because they're angry doesn't mean to say I got it wrong and I deserved it.
So when did you start to see a darker side to Rob?
I think, to be honest, it was that second date. Yeah. And you'd think that would be enough. But having never experienced anything like that, it was uncharted waters. Mm. And, you know, I have a very rational personality. So I thought, well, you know, if I do X, Y, Z, then it'll all shake out and we're just getting to know each other. But it was the whole, I didn't realise how he was just changing and modifying my behavior. It was all very, very subtle. Mm. And looking back at it now, I see that I was making excuses for him as well. And Linda had aired quietly, because she's not somebody to try and sort of cause a ruckus, but she quietly was, you know, are you okay? Is everything okay? Because she was my sponsor after all. And so she did see that there were some things in the personality that perhaps weren't healthy. Mm. And I very quickly got married. And I didn't know I was getting married that day. So you look at it
so
now.
So he sprung you into the marriage?
Yeah, he definitely sprung me into the marriage, yes.
How long have you been going out?
3 months.
What? So what happened? Surprise.
Well, he had asked me to marry him several times, and I either hadn't heard or just thought, just gone, you know, I'd been married before, wasn't in any hurry to get married again, and, you know, who knows what the future holds, you know, it's not on the radar. Mm. He said to me one day, well, why don't we just go to the registry office and just see that if you should ever change your mind, what are the steps would be needed, because you're not an American citizen and you're here on a green card and or a work visa. I didn't have a green card. So I said, yeah, okay, fine. So we went at lunchtime and he picked me up. He was, you know, muddy boots and, you know, baseball cap on backwards and a cut-off T-shirt. And there's me in my high tops, my shorts and straight out of the bench and just walked into the registry office and they said, well, you know, you can do this, this or this. And the third option was you can actually get married now by signing on the dotted line. And so he's like, honey, just sign there. And I'm like, oh, all right then. Because I mean,
and you didn't think to say no. I mean, it's really hard to understand.
It is rather, isn't it?
Yeah. No. Did he have a ring or anything? I mean, was there any kind of sense that he'd pre-planned it?
No, I don't know that he had pre-planned it. I just think he was such an opportunist that he was like, well, actually, we can get married now.
And controlling.
And controlling, because it was what he wanted. Yeah. It wasn't necessarily what I wanted. But again, I was like, oh, well. And that sounds all very irresponsible and blasé. But I have realised that I have this sort of jump attitude. It's like, oh, just here's the opportunity, go for it. Mm. What's the worst that can happen? I'm much older now and much wiser. A lot can happen, but I quite like that side to my personality. It hasn't completely gone at all.
But I think it's also really interesting looking back that actually people who do end up in abusive relationships, it's very hard to see the truth at the time. Can you just explain how you think that happens? Are you always looking for the good in the person, or you're kind of can't believe what's going on?
All of that was certainly my experience, because I also knew the vulnerable side of Rob. He was, you know, a human being too. He had all the same emotions. You know, he had a lot of life stories that were really, really hard.
So what was his childhood like?
Well, I've chosen not to go into his story because it's his story and he's not here to validate any of the stories. And I think there is a privacy that I want to keep.
You know. But did you find yourself excusing him because of his childhood and his?
That's a great question. And it's one that I have had to look really hard at myself to try and rationalize everything. And the two questions that I come up with all the time is, what's the difference between an excuse and facts? You know, it was, the fact is that this is what happened versus an excuse. You know, am I making excuses or am I explaining the facts? I haven't been able to differentiate other than the fact is the fact. This is what he told me happened in his childhood. And a lot of it I did get to hear through other members of the family that did in fact happen. So looking at it going, yeah, I can see how that would affect me badly. Mm-hmm. I can see. It doesn't excuse, or it doesn't, I can't join the dots as to why that would make a person become violent towards another person, other than excruciating insecurities, the fear of losing the person that you love the most and only get rid of them on your terms. Because he had chosen to dissolve his previous two marriages because they had behaved badly, were his words.
And did he become quite violent quite soon or not?
He became verbally abusive, which I have not experienced before in my life. Mm-hmm. The first time he was violent, boy, I was shocked. But I knew I was in trouble. I sensed it the instant the incident happened that triggered him. And I did run the wrong way through my house to where there was no escape. And I knew as I ran that way, what are you doing? You know, it's really weird when you look back and you think about all these things and you go, how could that have happened?
So what did happen?
Well, basically, he strangled me. He had been a wrestler, so he knew all the moves.
Oh.
And he knew exactly how to get me. And I basically was in the corner and he put his forearm under. And he did it in a way that it was bone on my throat to where all I could do was this. And he lifted me up. And so he was crushing the windpipe. And I just thought, well, this is it. This is not how I imagine my end being. And the fury in his eyes was I'd never seen anything like that either. So when he let me down and he said to me, I will never leave a mark where the people can see. I just thought, you better pay attention.
Mm. So, didn't you just think, run?
Well, I was in another person's country. I was in another country. In all of this sort of conditioning prior this event, I now can look and see how he had made me very dependent on him.
How did he do that?
Well, it's one of those things that I do question is whether it was intentional or just the way he operated was that way.
Yeah.
We know so much more about gaslighting and these terms of grooming and codependency and coercive behavior. These are terms that I now know.
Mm.
I didn't know then.
Mm.
I couldn't rationalize this behavior at all. This was a man who loved me.
Mm.
So I must have deserved that, was how I started to behave. Of course, that's absolute rubbish. Of course I didn't deserve that. No way.
And did he turn you against your family?
He tried. He did try, and that was not going to happen. He also was very cruel. On one visit, we'd come back to the UK, and I'm incredibly close to my brother, Steve. And he and Steve were spending a lot of time together. And so we'd got back to the US, and he said, I'm going to tell you now, your brother's seriously, seriously ill, probably terminal. He's told me this in confidence, so you can't tell anybody. So that's my brother. Who's terminally ill.
And was it true?
No.
No, he just made it up.
No, he was frightening me. He was testing me. And so for a long time, every time I spoke to Steve, I'm like, you're right. How's your health? And he'd be like, what's wrong with you, woman? And I was like, so everything's okay? Yeah, everything's fine. And after a while, I was just like. And I do remember saying to him, you know, Steve's fine. He went, oh, that's good. Oh, what a relief.
So you begin to lose your mind, really, don't you?
Mm. Yes, you do. Yes, I mean, sadly, you do. And it gets reflected back on you. So anything I would challenge him over, he was able to turn back on me to where my rational brain was beginning to spiral. I realise, looking back at it now, I was going into cope zone. It was all about coping and coping and coping while still very much loving this person. And this is where it's very difficult to explain. Even as these words come out of my mouth, I can understand anyone listening to me going, I still don't get it.
Mm. But then there are lots of people who'll be listening who've gone through the same sort of experience who will be getting it.
Yes, I have had a lot of people contact me since I've put a lot of this in the book that I've written. For me, this was not about rubbishing my husband's name. It's about understanding the complexities of somebody with this personality disorder. And I'm really keen to try and get to the crux of the matter.
Mm.
We have wonderful support for people who are on the receiving end of this kind of behavior. If we can limit it starting in the first place, wouldn't that be a great place to be?
Mm.
You know, understanding why people are becoming so desperate. And unfortunately, this behaviour is very much on the increase.
So was there a bit of you that almost wanted to save him and help him?
Yeah, absolutely. Because this is somebody I loved. So wouldn't you do anything for the person that you love? And just trying, again, that rationalisation of, we are together as a married couple. We are in this thick and thin and everything in between. We were building our lives together and there was lots that was very, very good.
Mm.
So this dark side, when it would appear, just couldn't understand why did it rear its ugly head? And there were times when it was more volatile than others and we both lost our fathers around about the same time, within 4 or 5 weeks of each other. We're both very close to our dads. So as individuals, it massively affected us. And it ended up with us really, you know, having a hard time with each other to the point where I did come home and I very nearly didn't go back to the US. You know, that was my opportunity to leave. But in the US, I had the animals. They were very much my family. I wasn't going to leave my animals. So you know, I had all of this turmoil going on in my head as to what was the right thing to do. Always try to do the right thing.
And did your friends ever say anything? Because I think that also is something that people want to know is if you have a friend in that situation, how do you get involved? What do you say? Or can you say anything? Or do you become so isolated that you stop seeing anyone?
Yeah, it's tricky. Very, very tricky. After my husband died, the amount of people that came forward and said, we didn't know what to say, Suze, but we had a suspicion.
That what should they have said, do you think?
God, well, Yeah, that's a tough one. Because if anyone would have challenged me, I would have defended.
Right.
And that, again, seems an irrational behaviour. But this was, you know, my family, my world. And now, I do talk about him threatening my dog in the book, and I would have absolutely taken a bullet for that dog. It wouldn't have helped because I'm sure he would have shot the dog afterwards, but that was my determination to protect the other things in my life that I loved. And if I'd been a mother, I would have absolutely, and I think that's a natural behaviour for a mother anyway, to protect their child at all costs. But you know, to think that he would threaten the things that I love in order to make me behave, just you know, the wickedness behind that sort of behaviour. And yet the other side of him was so remorseful and desperately just wanting to assure me that he wasn't all bad. And that became very much a conversation we would have in his last few weeks of life. I mean, he was just sort of really purging all of his angst and his demons.
So he knew what he'd done in the end?
He did, yes, which was, I look at the conversations that we had as being very healing. He was just being very open. And
did he apologise?
Yes, he did, yeah. Which I get comfort from because it was our relationship. I don't question why I take comfort for that. It was so raw. It was probably because the hard times were so incredibly hard that those tender, honest moments became so much more magnified. And it was, he knew he was close to death. So he, if he didn't say it then, he was never going to say it. And I'm really grateful that he said it.
But also the power dynamic at that point must have completely changed because he was vulnerable and weak and you were much stronger. So was there a moment where you felt that tipping over?
Yes. Yeah. And it was very sad. It was very, very sad. And I really felt for him because he was a very strong-minded man, physically very, very strong. He never saw a challenge as being insurmountable. He would take it on. And so as his body became weaker and weaker and he found his ability to do things, I first of all saw it in his eyes. And then he looked at me one day and he said, I physically just can't do this anymore. And for him to utter those words took a great deal of courage. But also he was done. And when you look at somebody who you've known being this incredibly strong person be cut down like this to where that's all they've got to give, your heart goes out to them. I mean, no one should ever go through that. And so my role through all of his illness right from the day he was diagnosed was whatever he wanted, he was going to have. You know, it didn't matter what he wanted.
But that is extraordinary because, you know, during your time together, I mean, it was nearly 18 years, wasn't he? He controlled very much things like what you ate, what you wore, and you didn't mind that at the end. There was no sense of revenge, was there?
No.
Why did you not mind him telling you what to wear or what to eat or how to behave in the end, do you think?
I don't think it was right what he did. I was just trying to do the right thing to navigate this relationship that I was in and find a happy sweet spot. You know, over time, you would hope that it would calm down. And things were slowly getting better. The year before he died, before his diagnosis, he turned to me and he said, "If it all ends tomorrow, I want you to know this is the best life I could ever have hoped for, and it's because of you." I mean, it's one of those really genuine, tender moments. So we were definitely making headway.
And I guess the tender moments make you realise it can be good sometimes, even when it's bad.
Yes.
Or, yeah.
Yeah. It's because I've been open about the abuse, physical and mental abuse. It's become, my marriage was an abusive marriage.
Mm.
I look at it as my marriage was challenged with this aspect of abuse.
Mm.
But that wasn't the whole marriage. Yeah. You know, it was a percentage of the marriage. The rest of the marriage was two people doing their very best with their own issues with any relationship.
But it sounds as if Rob did a lot of things that would undermine your confidence, like, for example, demeaning you in public. And what kinds of things would he do? Because that must just have been so isolating.
He would undermine me in front of other women.
Right.
To where if I dared to say anything to him, he'd go, "Oh, you're just being really insecure now, aren't you? Mm-hmm. Don't worry, honey, I will come home." And you just start making you feel like this big.
Yeah.
Because none of us want to be told that we're insecure, because it does undermine you. Of course it does. And I think we all have that capability of feeling insecure.
And you were isolated physically and mentally, yeah, really, weren't you?
So. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I didn't have my family. Mm. I didn't have my friends of old. And I certainly didn't want to worry my family.
But you had your pets.
But I had my pets. Mm. And, you know, the bandit. My dog, my main dog, the dog, once in a lifetime dog. Talk about a fantastic dog. Animals know. They just know. Instinctively, they know.
So did they try and protect you?
A bandit did.
Mm, right.
Yeah, yeah. And that's when Rob threatened to shoot him. Mm. And I said, you know, over my dead body.
And he had a sort of man cave, didn't he, with lots of pictures of naked women. Did you have anywhere you could go?
I had my workshop.
Mm.
And the whole naked women thing was very short-lived, because it wasn't in Rob's personality to do that. He kind of was just making a point, and it's when we had neighbours. We were living in town, and he had the garage where the boys would come over and drink, and he's like, "Yeah, I'm just going to, you know..." He'd got some centrefolds, and he was actually shocked when he came to the UK and he saw... in the newspapers then, you would have page 3. And he's like, "Honey." And I'm like, "Yes, so what? You know, I'd grown up with it. Who cares? It's not a problem." Going in a newsagent's top, you know, he was just like, "That's so wrong." And yet here he was in front of, you know, his friends going, "Yeah, this is going to be, yeah, I'm going to put up these centerfolds and da, 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 da." And at this time, I was really struggling and my weight had plummeted. I was about 7'10". I knew physically, I mean, I was a bag of bones, and he looked at me like this. And our neighbour was a voluptuous woman, and he would often just hang out with her. And we had one of those pop-up pools, and she'd come over and they'd all be playing together. And he'd like, "Suze, come out." And he'd go, "Yeah." And I just like, I knew. I mean, I was anorexic. I was just a mess. Mm. You know,
did you seek a doctor at all? I mean, did you ever go to anyone medical who looked at you and said, "You know, are there any issues?"
No, because that would have been another problem. Mm. Yeah, the whole doctor thing was, you know, there's some quite nasty stories there.
And so. You didn't go to the police either?
I phoned the police, yeah, I did. The one time on the farm, somebody in our circle of friends used to be a sheriff, as they're called over there, and I phoned him and he said, "Suze, you need to call the police." So I did. And the conversation went along the lines of, I explained what was going on. I explained that there were guns. And the cop that I spoke to said, "Well, ma'am, one of you's going to jail tonight. Who's it going to be?" And I thought, it's all very well them coming and arresting Rob, but he will get out. And it doesn't matter if you've got a restraining order. You're in the middle of nowhere.
Mm.
No one's going to protect you. So I just went, yeah, don't worry about it. But I knew it had been logged, and I did tell him. I said, you know, I've just called the police. And then friends came up and helped defuse the situation.
Because there was one time when he said he'd worked out how to kill you, didn't he? What did he say?
On a Saturday, I would spend all day going out saddle fitting, going around the barns and things like that. And I never knew what sort of person I'd meet on the way back in to the farm. And he'd been drinking very heavily and obviously got himself in a tailspin over something that, I don't know, who knows what happened. And he just turned to me as soon as I sat down with him and he said, I've worked out how to have you killed. And then he went into telling me how, and I've never shared what he would have got away with it. It was like, what do I do? Do I stay? Do I sit with him and talk through, trying to ignore the words that have just come out of his mouth? Or do I go to the workshop?
What did you do?
I don't remember. You just blanked it, do you think? Yeah, I'm sure I did. There's a lot of things that I buried very deep. Yeah. And in writing the book, some of it has come to the surface.
Because in the book, you talk about some of the good times, the sort of getting on the Harley Davidsons.
So. Yeah.
And have you purposefully tried to remember the positive as well?
There was a balance there. I mean, it was a normal relationship, except it does have the extremes. I mean, normal except for. So, yes, when you think about any relationship that you've been in, there's highs, lows, and everything in between. There's the mundane days. There's the day-to-day chug, chug, chug along. My dad said to Rob on one of our visits, good luck. Because my dad knew that I like to explore. I'm curious. That is probably most people's relationships, isn't it? It is good and bad.
And when he died of pancreatic cancer, how did you feel? Did you feel very angry in some ways that you'd stayed, or were you just grieving, or what were your, it must have been very complex, the emotions, what were they?
Well, I've never had a husband die before. So because of how his illness had progressed and how our relationship had changed through his illness and all of those moments of packing in as much life as possible, the moment that he died, I felt for him a great sense of relief because his last moments were not great. And I just felt so, so sorry for him because it was a life cut short. He was only 52 when he died. And I think anyone that witnesses a death like that, you can't help but feel it wasn't supposed to be like that. It is the reality.
But what did you feel for yourself?
I don't remember being conscious of my feelings at all. I do remember being conscious of what was happening around me. Things like Bailey, our dog, howling the moment he died. She wasn't even in the room. So that was spooky. And then as soon as I opened the door of the workshop, they ran into the house and they knew he had died. I mean, they just went to him and they licked him and they jumped on him. And you can see animals process when death has occurred. And then they calmed down and they just laid and they watched what was happening. It became this suspended moment in time where so much happened and yet time stopped. For me, in remembering it, weirdly, is a really beautiful moment. It's life.
And do you regret that period of your life? Or do you feel that actually it was an essential part of who you are now and that it's given you the kind of empathy that you need on the repair shop? Do you think it's made you tougher or more vulnerable?
I wouldn't have changed it for the world. I am so grateful for everything that's ever happened because it has given me the opportunity and the understanding of people's lives to a degree. If somebody shares an experience, every decade for me has got better, but I'm now in my 60s. And I'm really loving life. And I'm still very enthusiastic to what's coming around the corner. And I feel really energized every day. I still feel incredibly energized. And my curiosity is strong and my thirst to learn. I'm active and I'm riding every day. I think having had all these experiences have created the person that I feel I am today. Mm-hmm. And it is the moment that you're in today that really matters.
What do you wish you'd known when you were that little child who just got a pony and you were setting out at age 13? And what would you like to have said to yourself?
It'll be all right.
You've been listening to What I Wish I'd Known in association with Speakers for Schools, the youth social mobility charity that provides inspirational talks and work experience opportunities, with me, Rachel Sylvester.
And me, Alice Thompson. And our guest on this episode, Susie Fletcher. The series producer is Anya Pierce, and the editor was Callum McRae.
If you enjoyed what you heard, why not pick up a copy of our book, What I Wish I'd Known When I Was Young?
Or you can follow the podcast so you never miss an episode. And of course, you can listen back to all our previous episodes on the free Times Radio app or download them from wherever else you get your podcasts.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.